Right now, it is time once again to welcome in our good friends from the BerkshireEdge.com. Marcy and David, you'll find the BerkshireEdge.com at, that's right, the BerkshireEdge.com. And that's where you'll find just a whole bunch of information and news and events that are happening in our area. And they're there 24 hours a day, and they're here at least once a week. Good morning, guys.
We feel like we are there 24 hours a day. Not only is the site up 24 hours a day, but we feel like we're there 24 hours a day, too.
All right, now I have to. I wish I had something ready for this, but I wanted to play a news break opener, because your first story, the primary election results in Berkshire County, with what appears to me to be a pretty stunning story.
Well, it's a stunning upset.
Yeah,
David, you want to go ahead?
No, go ahead, Marcy.
We had in Berkshire County, we had two really hotly contested races, one for district attorney and the other for sheriff. Now, the most stunning news is the district attorney, which is very surprising. You know, 4 years ago, we elected Andrea Harrington, who was the first woman. She won against the Pittsfield Democratic Machine candidate. She was a reformer, but she apparently made a number of false steps, and she has been defeated after her one term by a man named Tim Shagrew, who seems to have much more experience than Andrea had. He has served, he's been a criminal attorney. He served as district attorney elsewhere. He's worked for the district attorney's office in Berkshire County. I mean, he's had a lot of specific experience in this kind of field, which Andrea did not. Although Andrea was a reformer, and she's been endorsed by Maura Healey, who is leaving the state attorney general's position to run for governor. She was also endorsed by Jamie Raskin, who came to Great Barrington to deliver a speech, and it turned out that he had been her law professor. And so she had a rally in which he endorsed her warmly. So she had a lot of people lined up on her side, and she was a reformer. She was the first woman. But she lost badly. Tim Shagrew defeated her, and I think there are going to be a lot of postmortems on this as to what happened to her.
All along, one thing, this is what's so great about the BerkshireEdge.com, is you openly reported the positive steps and the negative steps that Andrea did. And I think you're right. I think it was a culmination. It was an experiment to voters, and the voters who wanted progressive change and more progressive policies just did not turn out this year.
Right.
Right, and she may have been something of a disappointment to people. But, you know, it was also the fact that, she was not the Democratic Machine's chosen candidate, when she got elected 2 years ago. So, there is that element of a strong Pittsfield group that kind of rules the Democratic Party. So,
and I don't know whether it was because she's a woman that she was defeated. After all, we have voted for, it looks like we are, the Democratic candidates for governor and lieutenant governor are both women. So I don't think that it,
Well, she wasn't there as a strong, there's a sort of a Democratic machine in Pittsfield.
Yeah.
That kind of governs politics in Berkshire County, and she was not their chosen candidate, and that was the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem. And the other thing is that, she was accused of being soft on crime, And what she was trying to do, and it is a, you know, and it is a legitimate agenda, and people were, you know, there are other DAs around the country who are trying to do the same thing, but she was trying not to, she was trying not to prosecute petty crimes. I mean, she was trying, I mean, what she called petty crimes, and she was trying to focus on bigger crimes. She was trying not to criminalize people who she felt didn't need to be criminalized at such an early stage of their life or such an early stage of their criminal career. And so she was accused of being soft on crime. Anyway, I think there are going to be a lot of postmortems, which are going to be very interesting. You know,
right.
I don't know what Andrea will do. She was very ambitious. She had run for, I think, state senator and lost. And after she lost that, the district attorney race became available, and so she ran for that. So that, you know, there was a lot of mistrust also, I think, about, you know, whether she cared about the office or whether she was... whether her ambition was greater than her dedication to the office. So it's hard to know. She lost very resoundingly. It was a big difference. I mean, she lost by, you know, he got about two-thirds and she got one-third. So it was a decisive race.
That was a margin of about 6,000 votes. So.
Wow. Yeah, out of how many?
22,000.
Yeah, so that's...
that's a big margin.
Lost.
That's a big margin.
Yeah, that's a big margin. I mean, he got, let's see, at 10:54...
He had almost 14,000 votes.
And she had 85, almost 8,500. So it was...
Decisive.
Yes, it was quite decisive. And then we had this...
The race for sheriff.
Now, David and I were kind of amused by this because, you know, up to that point, I mean, we didn't even think about the sheriff. You know, we knew that a sheriff existed. But
that's because we're not familiar with the jail.
That's true. That, luckily.
But sheriffs also do traffic duty at Tanglewood, for example. It's a kind of a sinecure for some people.
Well, they oversee the jail.
Well, yeah, but they also do these traffic. They have these traffic duties, and that pays quite well to direct traffic into Tanglewood.
And they deliver summonses for the court.
Right. Yep.
But anyway, you know, we've had a very low-profile sheriff. I mean, I don't think... I certainly never knew what his name was, and what the sheriff did. And suddenly, so his name was Bowler. What's his first
name?
Tom Bowler.
Yep.
And along comes a man named Alf Barbalunga, and he is running for sheriff. And he had the most energetic campaign. You know, our managing director, Shaw Isaacson, said that he was overwhelmed with press releases. And then one day last week, like on a Monday, we were up to press release number 27. And then by Thursday, we were up to press release number 35.
So what was the final result of that race?
Well, Bowler won very decisively. I mean, the final race, the final number had.
Yeah, it was like...
He had almost 17,000.
Barbalunga had only
5,000,
okay.
Which is a big margin.
Yes. Big margin. I mean, he had three times. Bowler had more than three times as many votes than Barbalunga had. So it was 16,900 to 5,064.
Yeah.
And he, you know, really, this is the most energetic campaign I ever saw. And, you know, I kept wondering, what is it about the sheriff's office that's so appealing to this guy? But he wanted it badly, and he'd be interesting to know where the votes came from. All right. I don't know if we'll be able to get an analysis like right. that.
Well, at this point, I think we should move on from politics and go to something that's not only on the national spotlight, but it has been on the local spotlight for a long time, and that is water. Housatonic residents continuing to protest against I won't even call it rusty. I'll just call it about the water that they call water is emanating from the company.
Well, it looks like, you know, we have a picture of someone holding up a glass with this brown liquid in a glass that is that they got from their, faucets.
And we had a picture last week of a child in a bathtub, in this brown water. I mean, so we've talked about this a lot before. I mean, the town of Housatonic has a privately owned water system, and the owner, a guy named Jim Mercer, has not kept up, and I don't think he can possibly afford to keep up. And so the water is awful, the residents have, they've become much more actively fed up than they have been in the past. We had a story a couple of weeks or last week about a woman named Denise Forbes who lives in Housatonic, who was really leading the charge, and she was also extremely active.
She runs a B&B too. So
not anymore. They closed
it. Not anymore. They closed it.
But she did run a B&B, but she lives in Housatonic, and she was also when there was a fight against a marijuana processing plant in. Near Housatonic. She was also very active in that, too. So she's a serious community activist. And anyway, the final straw was last week. The water company announced that in order to, first of all, that they met compliance with the state on many levels, but that in order to address the manganese problem, which they said, is what's causing the color, they were going to have to raise the rates, and that's kind of the last straw. So there, we had a big demonstration on Saturday in downtown Great Barrington in front of City Hall. I mean, there were a lot of people there. I think we had a story. We had lots of pictures. I think we had a story about it.
Yep.
So this is now, this has come to the boiling point, and
so to speak.
So to speak, right. And the residents of Housatonic are now appealing to the state to do something about this. And, it's no longer a little quiet thing.
This is an interesting situation, actually. It's historic. That a water system could be privately owned rather than being a public utility. I mean, it goes back to the days when, we had turnpikes where roads were publicly owned. Privately owned. And so this guy, Jim Mercer, his family has owned this water system in the little village of Housatonic for forever. And they just can't. The rates don't.
That's right, and the way things stand now, with how small the water company is, the rates as a private company will never be able to catch up.
No, they won't. And finally, I think it's come to the point where, the water system is just sort of breaking down because it's old,
right?
And they don't have the resources to upgrade it. So that's why there aren't private water systems.
Right.
Yeah, there's
not enough of the resources to maintain the system.
Maybe if over the years they had maintained the system bit by bit, that they could still do it. But once you fall behind, and every year upgrades and things are needed in these public water systems. Once you fall that far behind, you'll never catch up. It's just it's just one of those things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and then it's a cascade of issues. Yeah.
All right. Well, so much for the water. Let's talk now about your Carol Owens discussion.
Oh yes.
residential tax exemption that's been proposed in Stockbridge. And it would allow second homeowners pay taxes at a higher rate than full-time residents.
Well, it would actually allow full-time residents to pay at a lower rate than second homeowners.
People in Armenia listen to the story because they, you know, the taxes. Some people at Silo Ridge, who moved into Silo Ridge, want the same want the same taxes as the people who live out in the community, and they're just you're comparing Trump Tower to a two-bedroom house. I mean, it's, you know, so this is a problem that's not only in there, but it's everywhere. So let's get to the gist of the story, because I think people in the Armenia area would be very interested in this.
I think so, too. I mean, and not only, this is not something that the town of Stockbridge made up. This is actually a longstanding law on the books in Massachusetts that part-time residents can be taxed differently from full-time residents. It's allowed by the Commonwealth by law. It's mandatory to vote on it every year at a mandatory tax classification meeting. But it hasn't been, you know, applied here. Apparently, it has been applied in towns across Massachusetts. And so now, you know, Stockbridge is an odd community because 60% of the houses in Stockbridge are owned by second homeowners.
That's like Salisbury. Yeah, it's like Salisbury.
Yes, is that right?
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
And they say that of the second homeowners, the primary population, 13% live below the poverty line. The median income is $62,000, but the average income, the per capita income, is $42,000. So it's, you know, the income of these permanent residents is much lower than the income of the second homeowners, one imagines, because these people are able to have two homes, and the people with only one home are struggling.
Furthermore, the people with the second homes up here are not here all the time.
Right, and so their argument, of course, is that they are paying full property taxes. I mean, the second homeowners are saying they pay full property taxes, but they don't really use the services, so they are supporting the community. You know, they are not using the schools. They don't use the roads. You know, they only use them part of the time. They are, you know, they're not using other kinds of community services. So they feel that they are already paying, you know, paying for the town. And now this suggestion comes along, and it's really very angry. So Carol Owens, who is, you know, I mean, her article is really begging for some civility in the discussion. But in fact, she is a supporter of this, and she proposes numbers that you know, would prove that the burden on second homeowners would not be so high. That it would be, you know, for example, if your house was assessed at $700,000, a resident, I mean, a full-time resident, would get a reduction in taxes of $1,400, but the non-resident would only be paying $812 more. But once you get into higher, like once you get to a $1 million house, the second homeowner would be paying almost $1,200 more. Once you're at $1.5 million, you're paying $1,700, and once your house is assessed at $2 million, you would be paying $2,300 more. But I think so the money difference is significant for, you know, for second homeowners, especially for people with much bigger houses.
Presumably that's you know, I would think that tax rate would hardly be noticeable to some of these people.
Well, you know? who knows? I mean, well, that may be the case, but I think that the big issue is that the second homeowners are feeling discriminated against, you know, that they feel that many of them have been here forever. I mean, I know, I have a cousin who has lived, who's had her house in Stockbridge probably for 40 years. I mean, she feels that she is, Stockbridge is a very important part of her life, and she spends a lot of time here, and she is now made to feel like she doesn't belong. And I think that's a lot of it. The town is being split between full-time residents and part-time residents. And there's a lot of anger. So this is unfortunate.
I've got a hack for those people if they pass this law. Change your city of residence to Stockbridge, and then wait for your other town to do the same thing.
Yeah. Save well, you know, money. You can't. I mean, if you're a New Yorker and you have to prove to the state of New York that you're out of New York. What is it, 187 days?
Yeah.
Because New York is very sensitive to second homeowners trying to avoid New York taxes. you may get stuck unless you can prove that you spend 187 days here as a primary resident.
Yeah.
You're going to be, New York is not going to let you go.
All right. Let's get on to your final story because we only have about 2 minutes, and that is, once again, one of your commentators offers a story about that, not out of the woods yet with COVID-19.
Right, right.
Oh, this is Mickey Friedman, yeah. He's cautioning that we are being about complacency with this pandemic, and with good reason, actually.
And he shows lots of statistics.
Yes, he does.
I know in the last 3 weeks, I know about five or six people who've come down with COVID. We're not over it. I mean, the cases may be milder than we had 2 years ago, but there's always the risk of long COVID, which is very debilitating and doesn't go away. It's an interesting story, and he's based it on a lot of statistics
He's done a lot of research.
Right. So it's a very interesting story.
Yeah, it's a cautionary story, that's for sure.
All right. Well, as we head from summer into fall and soon into winter, the beat goes on in South County.
The beat does go on.
Yes,
I would like
does.
To, if we have another minute, I
yes.
just want to bring to people's attention. You know, we publish a beautiful printed magazine called Out and About with the Berkshire Edge, but we also put those same articles online. And so we have, in our magazine section, we have several articles that are tremendous resources to the community. We focused in this article on antiques and vintage and how the whole vintage market has changed. We have a whole list of all the places where you can buy antiques and vintage all around the Berkshires, into Connecticut, into New York, into Vermont, and also where all the fairs, the antique and vintage fairs, take place.
All right.
For anybody who is interested in either antiques or vintage or just collectibles, this is a tremendous resource in our magazine section, and no one else has anything like this. So I recommend that people take a look at it. It's a full list of all the places where you can shop.
All right.
It's online.
And it's online with links to all the fairs and all the individual stores and a sort of a description of what's hot and what's not. So very, very interesting.
All right. Say hello to Shaw for me.
Yes.
You got a great guy there. I've known Shaw for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It's so good to see you.
We think so, too.
All right.
All right, guys. We'll speak to you next week.
Okay.
Bye.
Take
Thank
care.
You.
Bye. You're good.
Okay. That is the BerkshireEdge.com on air here on Robin Hood Radio and RobinHoodRadio.com.